Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. Welcome to episode 32 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Saturday, January 26, 2019. Joining us in the art house, you will meet Michelle Irizarry. She is a visual artist living in Orlando, Florida, USA. Michelle is also a civil engineer. As a result of climate change, she has seen a big transformation in her work as an artist. You will also hear responses to last month's Citizens Climate Radio Puzzler question. Your friend, Janet, is resistant to a bipartisan legislative climate solution. Janet says, right now, I don't trust any plan that has conservatives involved. Janet has fears and doubts that need to be addressed. Later in the show, I will share your responses. But first, I speak with two men from Appalachia, a coal mining region in the USA. Both worked in coal mines and both come from a long line of coal miners. After providing a fuel source to power a nation for over 100 years, energy sources are rapidly changing. We talk about the challenges coal miners have faced in the past and today. Meet Michael Ray Witten. Running through the center of Petona, in between the Petona Southern Baptist Church and B&P Gifts, is the Big Coal River. Coal and coal mining have played a major role in Michael Ray's life.
I worked 8.5 years at one mine, and I was employed at that mine 3 different times. Laid off, I went back to construction. I'd worked construction a little bit after I came out of service, and then after that first layoff, I went back to construction, and then they opened the strip mines. I worked at the strip mines 4 years of that time.
Mining is hard work, and coal miners face multiple health risks from long exposure to coal dust and silica. Michael Ray decided he needed to find other employment so he could avoid these dangers. He saw firsthand the punishing toll coal mining had on his father.
I didn't want to ruin my health by working in the mines. He worked all his life in the mines, maybe 27, 28 years, and his lungs were ruined. His last shift, my brother and I went down to the foot of the hill where our driveway started, up to the house, and we got under each arm and helped him up the hill. And on the way up, he was apologizing. I'm sorry. I can't work anymore. And he couldn't. He tried to work a little bit, state road job, but it was just sporadic, and he really didn't work after that. He just couldn't. In the last 2 years of his life, he fought for every breath he had. It's a terrible disease.
Growing up in rural Appalachia in a community with basically one major industry, his family at times faced serious financial challenges. His father sometimes struggled to pay the bills.
Every time he'd get straightened out financially, he'd lose everything he'd got, and we'd be down at the bottom again, and the family would suffer for it. And one time, he'd laid off for a long time, and he had borrowed a little bit of money. He bought some things to work on the house, make our house better, and he couldn't pay. He felt bad when he owed someone. So I think I was about 13, I'm gonna say 13. And he decided the only way he could pay back was to sell our timber around our home, 13, 14 acres, I don't know. It's for old family land. That was his share of the family, grandpa's land. You know, we spent a lot of time in the woods. When they cut that timber, my mom got really upset. And I remember her crying. She said, she asked my dad, said, we're going to have to stop these guys. And he said, I can't. I have a contract. I've sold this to them. Well, the contract was to cut none of the small timber, just cut the large. They didn't do that. And two men and two horses destroyed our environment. And it grew up to briars and thickets. I guess that's when I started appreciating nature, appreciating everything about what the Lord has given us to live on.
The financial and health risks miners in Appalachia face came up in another conversation I had with a son of a coal miner. Nick Mullen's father and grandfather were miners.
I'm currently living in Berea, Kentucky. I have a communications organization based on trying to alleviate the issues of the jobs versus environment debate.
More about that work in a moment. Nick explains coal mining has brought prosperity to the region and also troubles.
Appalachian people have always suffered because of the coal industry. It has provided jobs, true enough. It's given us some mobility in terms of finances. You know, I came up in the 80s. My dad worked a union coal mining job underground, and I had a lot of the things that kids had growing up in the 80s. We had C-band satellite dish, so we had Nickelodeon, MTV. I had a Nintendo, and I enjoyed these things, and they were great for us. But at the same time, I knew what it was doing to my father. He was having to work in the mines. He was working in dangerous situations. He was giving up his health in the long term. And whenever the union mines left, it got even worse. My great-grandfather died of black lung. Both my grandfathers had lung issues and joint issues. Their last parts of their life wasn't as pleasant as it should have been. I have uncles whose backs are damaged. My dad's back is damaged. And, you know, I have an uncle who I've never known to be off of crutches. And the coal industry, even whenever it does provide jobs, takes a toll on people's health. The miners themselves and the communities where we live. The coal processing, the slurry impoundments, the waste that's left behind, the damage to our aquifers, the damage to our mountains and streams, it all adds up.
Black lung disease came up constantly in every conversation I had with coal miners and in my research for this episode. To learn more about the disease, I turned to Dr. Natasha DeJeanette. She is a researcher and public health expert at the National Environmental Health Organization. She begins by highlighting how vital rural communities are to the nation as a whole.
There's so much that comes out of our rural communities that we need. We need food, we need energy, and we need water. You know, this makes life possible all across the U.S.
While those living in rural communities, like in Appalachia, provide so much, their work at times comes at a severe cost to them, especially in coal mines.
They're very risky jobs, and because of the lack of economic diversity in these communities, they're often some of the best jobs in the communities. But the health hazards that come along with it are shocking and saddening. I believe that no one should have to be put at added health risk so that they can provide for themselves and their families.
Coal miners can develop various lung diseases, in particular pneumoconiosis. According to the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, pneumoconiosis is a group of lung diseases caused by the inhalation of certain dust. The lung tissues react to the dust, Dr. DeJeanette explains.
You're breathing in this coal dust or silica, and it is scarring the lung. And this is happening over a long period of time. Not being able to get enough air in, to complete your daily task, to feel like you're suffocating, it is just awful.
Before black lung disease forms in their lungs, many coal miners first develop anthracosis, a blackening of the lung tissues. While there are often no obvious symptoms, over time, with more exposure to coal dust, the condition worsens. It leads to scarring in the lungs. Anthracosis doesn't just affect coal miners, though. It's a fairly common condition among people who are exposed to air pollution in cities. This is especially true in communities where people of color live and in lower-income neighborhoods. Both those who breathe in the coal dust while mining and those living in communities where coal has been used to produce energy experience chronic sickness and disease.
Of course, we need energy because the energy that we have helps power our hospitals and our daily activities. It allows us to eat and drink and allows us to access our needed services. However, the primary source of energy that we've been using for quite some time is harmful for those that mine it out of the mountains. And then when it is burned in our communities, in the more urban settings, then it is also quite harmful to those who are exposed to the burning of fossil fuels. It's really quite toxic all around, full circle.
Coal mining happens in many parts of the world, including Australia, South Africa, Poland, and India. Depending on safety precautions and techniques used, miners are exposed to more or less risk. In the USA, coal miners have had a long history of developing pneumoconiosis, or black lung disease. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health has been tracking the disease.
They report that 1 in 10 underground coal miners who've worked in the mines for at least 25 years were identified as having black lung disease.
1 in 10 nationally. But in Appalachia coal country, where both Michael Ray Witten and Nick Mullins live, something is starkly different.
Those that have spent 25 years in coal mines, 1 in 5 within Appalachia report having black lung disease.
Not only are miners in Appalachia developing the disease at alarming rates, they're affected by it earlier in life than previous generations. Now there are miners in their 40s with the disease. One possible cause of this is because miners in Appalachia have to drill through much more rock in order to get to the coal. After years of mining coal, it's now getting harder to extract. Miners now experience greater exposure to silica dust. This dust is more abrasive to the lungs than coal dust. There is a big push to help miners transition to safer jobs. As Michael Ray Witten explained to me, though, retraining takes time and money.
I borrowed money to get to the job, and then I had to retrain after I got there. You've got to take care of your family, you have to take care of yourself. You have to just do what you got to do. From West Virginia, it's kind of been that way all throughout our history. You know, it's been up and down.
There are state and federal programs that help retrain coal miners. Michael Ray says, though, some miners are resistant to change.
I think that it's really hard to persuade somebody to join one of those programs. A couple counties over trained the coal miners. They retrained for solar. The lady that came in, she trains nationwide, and she said those coal miners just adapted to that better than any crew she'd ever worked with. And she said when they'd run into a problem, they wouldn't even ask her. They just could solve it themselves. She said they brought all their own tools. She said, I didn't have to fly anything.
Nick Mullins has been speaking out about the need to transition away from coal. Talking about his family's experience in the mines led him to start an organization.
Breaking Clean is basically the culmination of a couple of speaking tours that we did over the past 3 years. So we went out on the road as a family, speaking about the issues of extraction in places in the Northeast and even the Pacific Northwest, specifically around coal, but also the need for more sustainable lifestyles. This was while I was attending Berea College, pursuing a degree in communications, as well as minoring in sustainability and environmental studies and Appalachian studies. So it was kind of putting together all the things that I was hoping to do post-graduation. So Breaking Clean has now become an organization created to help continue on doing this communications, media, and advocacy work for small budget organizations that are trying to do grassroots organizing in their areas.
Conversations about climate change and coal get tense, especially in Appalachia. Nick, though, is excited about advancing the conversation.
To me, the climate is important. Admitting that there is a problem, working to alleviate there is a problem. We also have to understand that in Appalachia, climate change has a totally different meaning for people. It is that jobs killer. It is that that proverbial war on coal that's been waged, according to politicians and the coal industry media organizations. They're grassroots or groups, if you call them that, or Friends of Coal and the coal associations. What I like to get down to is the fact is that, yes, climate change is affecting Appalachians because of a decreasing demand for coal or this negative attention around coal that it gives. But we also have to understand that this is very much a push in the right direction for Appalachian people.
Earlier, Michael Ray Witten told us the story of his father's financial struggles. To provide for the family, his dad sold the trees that surrounded the family home. As a young teen, this uprooting of this forest he knew all his life made a lasting impact on Michael Ray. He's been thinking about that incident, the pain and anger he felt when they cleared the land he loved. It's opened him up to reflect on the impact of coal mining, pollution, and climate change.
It began a long time ago when those guys cut all our trees around our house. Yeah. I didn't realize it when I worked in the mines, what kind of damage I was doing. I just thought it as a job. After I got in construction, I worked at the windmills a couple of times, and they leave a very small footprint on the earth. And I destroyed a lot while I worked at the mines.
I'm grateful that more and more coal miners and their families are telling their stories and people are hearing those stories. Recently, Howard Berkus at National Public Radio produced a powerful and moving segment about coal miners. It's based on an investigation into the recent dramatic increase in black lung disease in Appalachia. An epidemic of the disease is killing thousands of coal miners. The investigative journalists claim regulators could have stopped it. You can find links to that story and much, much more over at our show notes. Go to citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. Click on the Citizens Climate Radio option and look for episode 32. Joining us in the Art House today is the award-winning painter Michelle Irizarry. Michelle lives in the U.S. state of Florida. She actually never studied art. She graduated from Massachusetts Institute of Technology with a degree in civil engineering.
I do hydrologic modeling of the Everglades ecosystem and the heavily managed areas of South Florida, like Miami to West Palm Beach. It's one of the most heavily managed water resource systems in the world.
Her background in engineering influences her art.
I think my engineering career has made me more aware of the issues and what is at stake when it comes to environmental pollution and climate change.
Initially, Michelle's understanding of climate change was academic, but then it became personal.
Yes, I am a mother of two girls, a 7 and a 10-year-old. For a long time, climate change was like a very abstract issue to me. But once I had my kids, I started worrying about it more. And since we're actually seeing some of the effects earlier than we thought.
As you will hear, Michelle's climate art is infused with her emotions, her experiences, and a strong, clear message. But she did not start out as a climate change visual artist.
Yeah, art has always been a hobby for me. It has been a way of relaxing, you know, kind of like a meditation. So I was always drawn to to the pretty things, to florals and landscapes. So I would display my art at local galleries, go to festivals, and I would be able to sell my paintings every now and then. Now that I'm doing more environmental art, it's a little bit harder to sell the work. It's not just about selling for me, it's about communicating through my art.
Just as having children changed Michelle's relationship to climate change, her growing concern about climate change has transformed her art.
To be honest, most of my life I didn't feel like painting figures and faces. I thought they were too difficult, so I avoided them. But now I think they're a central part of my work, and the more I do them, the easier it gets. I used to paint quite small, maybe 8 by 10, 16 by 20, and the size of my paintings is growing because I'm trying to convey so much information. So a lot of my pieces right now are 30 by 40, 48 by 48. They have definitely grown in size in the last few years.
Michelle tells me about two of her paintings. Notice how she weaves her personal life and her message about the environment into the art.
So right now I'm working on a piece where I am showing my two girls, and they're on this deserted land where the soil is cracking and it's very dry, and you can see the power plants in the background. They are wearing a gas mask and they have all the toys around them. And I'm titling this piece, Where Will the Children Play? Because I am very concerned about the habitability of the planet that I'm leaving to my kids.
Michelle places a single pink flower in the center of the painting in between the two figures. The girls are looking at this flower.
Yeah, it's a desert flower. So it only grows in the Southwest. I don't exactly remember the name of it, but I wanted to add that little flower coming out of the cracks in the soil as a symbol of hope for what we can do, that we can still manage it if we act right away.
In a moment, I'll tell you how you can see this painting for yourself online. Now, those of us who do climate work feel many strong emotions. These feelings can be disorienting and overwhelming. Michelle explores these emotions in a painting called Drowning in Thoughts. On the bottom half of the painting, we see the profile of a woman underwater. She is painted with cold blue and purple tones. Her one visible eye is closed and her head tilts down. She looks like she's carrying a heavy weight. Swimming in her hair are fishes painted in warm colors of burnt orange and yellow.
Yeah, that one in particular, I was thinking about the ocean, but I also personally went through a very difficult time some years ago. And just thinking about it, it makes me feel like I'm drowning. I mean, I can also extend that to the issue of climate change. Just reading the news every day, it's very difficult. It gets to a point where I had difficulty sleeping. Sometimes I think we get overwhelmed with all the information that's out there that can be quite frightening, and it feels like we're literally drowning. Art has a way of evoking emotions in people and making them think in different ways. And I am hoping that by doing more environmental art, I can start some conversations. You know how climate change is such a political issue right now? I am trying to bridge that barrier and get people talking about issues that may be a little bit uncomfortable.
Michelle uses her climate art to start conversations about global warming and its impacts. She also paints multicolored images that mirror the emotions many of us feel. Ultimately, though, like many of the artists I feature on this program, Michelle creates art for herself.
It's mostly about putting in paper or in a canvas my feelings and my emotions about many of these issues. If some people can relate to my work, then that's even better, but that's not necessarily the main purpose.
You need to see Michelle Irizarry's work for yourself. She has both a website and a Facebook page. Her website is maritza.com. That's spelled M-I-R-I-Z-A, maritza.com. Michelle has a Facebook page where she posts new work. If you go to Facebook, in the search field, type in maritza.com and her page pops up. You can also follow her on Twitter at Maritza76. Again, Maritza is spelled M-I-R-I-Z-A. I have all these links for you in our show notes. Just go to the blog at citizensclimatelobby.org. Look for episode 32 of Citizens Climate Radio. If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. Now it is time for our puzzler question. Last month's question has to do with opposition some folks have to bipartisan legislative solutions to address fossil fuel pollution. One of your coworkers, Janet, is a progressive liberal who also wants to see us do something about climate change. But she's pushing back when you talk about your bipartisan climate group. She says, right now, I don't trust any plan that has conservatives involved. For all I know, that group is just the lying, greenwashing enemy of environmental justice. Janet has fears and doubts that need to be addressed. So how did you respond? I received several emails from you. I will share two of them with you. And I invited voiceover actor Richard Bowen to read them for us.
A listener from England cheekily calls himself Will Askerly. He writes, Janet's right to be wary since she had her trust burned. She needs to build trust again when she's ready. The art is to find overlap with the things people want to positively endorse and negatively avoid. If you have an intersection of interest, engage with those people. If we're to stay within the Goldilocks zone of not too cold, not too hot for the most people on the planet, we need to find the Goldilocks zone of adequate community interaction. Irreversible climate change is going to be avoided by building community with allies, people who share an intersection of interest and have earned our trust. Peterson also received this message from Arvia Morris in Seattle, Washington. I would listen to Janet's concerns and acknowledge her fears. I would make an effort to get to know Janet better on a personal level. Knowing we have a concern for climate change in common is very motivational for me. Since we are co-workers, maybe go out to lunch, or bike to work, or do something low-key that we both enjoy. Hopefully, we would develop a level of personal trust, and I would learn more about her ideas and how she views the world. If there is a climate event I think she would enjoy, movie, speaker, training event, lobby day, etc., and I want to go too, I would make a big effort to try to go together. If our personal connection is pretty good, I would invite some of my friends in my bipartisan group and ask her to invite some of her friends. I would see if anyone wants to meet before or after to just relax and do more get to know you. We don't want to get into a policy debate, but focus more on who we are and why we care about climate change.
Thank you, Richard, and thanks to the many people who wrote in with answers. So, are you ready for our new puzzler question? Here goes. At a family gathering, you're chatting with your cousin, Dan. You mentioned climate change, and he has a meltdown. He says, I feel so discouraged. All over the world, you have leaders in Brazil, the U.S., and parts of Canada opposing any action on climate change. I hate to give up, but maybe we just have to wait a couple of years before we can do anything. What do you say to Dan to help address this discouragement he has? If national leaders are not acting on climate change, what could we do? Send me your answers. Leave your name, contact info, and where you're from. Get back to me by February 15th, 2019. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Better yet, though, please consider leaving a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at the following number, 518-595-9414. Plus one if calling from outside the USA. That number again is 518-595-9414. Citizens Climate Radio is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, Allison Cabisco, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. Special thanks to my guests, Michael Ray Witten, Nick Mullins, and Dr. Natasha DeJeanette. Thanks to Jim Probst and Ellie Sparks from the Citizens Climate Coal Country Community Group. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guest. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.